I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Welcome to this episode of The Cauldron. We have the wonderful Lindsay Hookway in the bubbling pot with us today. If you haven't heard of Lindsay, then listen in. She's an experienced paediatric nurse, children's public health nurse, an IBCLC researcher, responsive sleep parenting advocate, and the author of 6 books. She has worked with children and families for more than 20 years within inpatient paediatrics, paediatric ambulatory care, the NICU, and the community. Lindsay is a PhD researcher at Swansea University, exploring the needs and challenges of medically complex breastfed infants and children. In 2019, she founded the Breastfeeding the Brave project to raise awareness of the unique lactation needs of sick children in the paediatric setting. Lindsay is the co-founder and clinical director of the Holistic Sleep Coaching Program and the Thought Rebellion. She is a respected international speaker and also provides regular training, advocacy and consultancy to both the NHS and private organisations. We get to talk all things infant sleep in this episode. We talk about how breastfeeding is often the scapegoat in the infant sleep scenario, how challenging it can be as a healthcare professional to even give sleep information. We venture in on those common myths of infant sleep advice and the pseudoscience available online. We discuss the fact that there is no real training for healthcare professionals on this topic. And lastly, we discuss not only what the current science is saying, but also how we can effectively, gently, and with safe evidence implement sleep support into our own practice. We're a bit sniffly on this episode, so get out the ginger tea and the hankies with us and sit in front of the fire. Or better yet, stretch your legs out in the warm sun as you tuck into another episode of The Cauldron. Lindsay Hookway, welcome to The Cauldron. It is an absolute blooming pleasure to have you finally with us. And I say us, it is just me today. Rachel is sleeping in her little bed in Queensland and we are meeting a little bit late for her. So Rachel sends her regards and is rather jealous that it's just me talking to you, but a big hello and welcome in The Cauldron.
Thank you. Well, we can simmer away together, just two ingredients instead of three, but hopefully we won't ruin the recipe today.
I reckon you've got way more than one ingredient to bring us today, because we are going to be talking all things sleep. And I will have a warning, listeners, you probably can hear that I've got a stuffy nose, and poor Lindsay is also afflicted with the cold of some bug, so we might sound a bit bunged up.
We're going to try and coordinate the coughs and sneezes, aren't we?
Yeah, I might not edit them and just leave them in if we can do that. Oh, and I'll definitely try and edit those sniffles. They're not very appealing.
Not pleasant.
So, Lindsay, can you, for our audience who might not know you, give us a little taster of how you came into what you're researching and what you're currently passionate about and what your job is, really?
That is, I don't have one of those careers where you can just neatly say I do this, this and this, but my background is in paediatric nursing and health visiting, and we've just established that that's actually where we actually met about 17 years ago, which has made us both feel a little old this morning. But I became an IBCLC about 11 years ago. And my passions are supporting responsive parenting and feeding. And I got into sleep work because I kept on seeing that breastfeeding was what I called a sleep scapegoat. So
I saw
time and time again was that when babies weren't sleeping, like a lot of the mainstream books said they should be sleeping, basically breastfeeding got the blame. It was
absolutely,
your baby's not sleeping through the night. Oh, that's breastfeeding. You know, jack the breastfeeding in and it'll all be well.
Yeah.
And I kept seeing it. So I got into sleep via my first love, which was breastfeeding. So lots of people know me for responsive sleep advocacy, but actually breastfeeding is how it got me there in the first place. And so it's kind of driven by a desire to help people understand normal infant behavior. And alongside that, because I'm a pediatric nurse and a lactation consultant, I have also been frustrated for about 20 years that pediatrics is not a brilliant place to have a breastfeeding crisis, because it's the one part of the clinical hospital and community environment where there is no standard breastfeeding training available to pediatric professionals. So that's why I started my PhD in how to support breastfeeding medically complex children in pediatrics. So that's coming to an end. But so I basically have my fingers in lots of pies, and we're here to talk about the sleep pie, I believe, today.
That's what I'm bringing you on for. You do have many fingers in pies, and I could talk to you all day about so many different issues. But the sticky finger today and the pie we want is the pie of sleep. So I'm not sure if we're getting pie charts in there. But I chose this because it is always a hot topic. And I don't think just for families, but also for us as healthcare professionals, it can be a really challenging area to navigate. And I hope that we can get some enlightenment from you, Lindsay, today. That's a big ask.
All the answers.
Yeah, I only invite people on who have all the answers. This is it.
I'm going to fix it. I'm going to fix it in 40 minutes. No, you're right. I think one of the problems is it's quite dichotomous, that there are sort of two big narratives. One is that, you know, babies behave like babies. It's all normal. Just bed share and put them in a sling and this too shall pass and it'll all be fine and you're doing great and don't worry about it. One end of the extreme. And then the other end of the extreme is, babies don't sleep, but you don't have to put up with that. Of course you have to sort it out. Of course you have to go back to work. It's going to ruin your mental health. It's going to ruin your relationship. You're going to drive your car off the road if you don't sleep train your baby. So you've just got to tough it out and let them cry. And the problem is that, there are lots of problems with that, but one problem is that it's quite polarizing. And so there's quite vicious arguments on both sides. And that's not really an argument I want to get into, because ultimately if people have made an informed choice, then obviously that's their parental right to make a decision about how they want to raise their little one. So that it's not really an argument I want to get into, but it's the other problem with it is that a lot of people who are listening to parents describing how difficult it is to, you know, care for a young baby or even an older baby for that matter, they find themselves kind of at a loss in terms of what tools to give parents, because, you know, this too shall pass, you know, wait it out, doesn't always sit well when you've got a parent who's kind of falling apart. And yet that parent might not want to cry it out either. So people can end up feeling a little bit sort of lost without a strategy or a tool to provide. So that's the very, very murky grey line that I try to tread, is one that is respectful to little ones' need for constant 24/7 responsiveness and emotional scaffolding and prompt attuned caregiving, but also, do you know what, it's really hard and this too shall pass and, you know, hang on in there, doesn't always cut it when people are falling apart.
It's highly distressing at that point when, often when, as a lactation consultant, you know, someone's coming to you about breastfeeding and sleep challenges, they are extremely distressed. And balancing their mental health with also the mental health of their baby is one of the hardest challenges I find as well in my practice as lactation. And I've read a lot of books. I've also read the ones which I just would used to hide in the library into sections where I didn't think any mums would venture or any parents. And
put in the fiction section or the science.
Things you're
fiction.
Not going to do when you're really tired. That would be my thought process. It's like, where would I put this? I'm sure I'm on camera on many libraries for hiding them. I know exactly.
I have what I call fondly my shelf of shame. So I won't show you, but I might do later, maybe when we're not recording. But I have a shelf of shame. These are the books that I need to know about, but I think are basically only useful as firelighters.
Yeah, there's been a lot of kind of damage that's been done over the last, well, century, but also recently. And, you know, there seems to be a lot about routines and making sure that we're starting routines early, doing specific feeding techniques, play techniques, sleep techniques. It feels kind of overwhelming as well. Yeah. And I would often get, you know, over the years, mums would come in and see me and they will have read certain books and they have been doing this for, I don't know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and they're at breaking point because it's not working, in quotes, and their baby's not fitting the mold or their baby's not the perfect baby. And of course, on the back of these books is hundreds of testimonials. And oh God, I just think it's such a difficult area, because if your brain's been flooded with all this information, and especially when we're reading that during pregnancy as well, and planning how we're going to have a sleep routine and not understanding the basics, this can really set us up for feeling quite awful, to be honest.
Yes, there are so many myths, and we could actually, I do sometimes talk about them all day long because there are so many of them. There's the myths. It sounds so sanitized, doesn't it, in the books? You know, do these things at these times, give these volumes of milk. It's often weighted towards formula fed babies as well. And that's one of the reasons why people get confused and breastfeeding gets derailed, because the subtle implication, or sometimes it's not even that subtle, is the formula fed babies sleep better. And, you know, yeah, breastfeeding is great, but if you want your baby to sleep, you're going to have to formula feed them, or at the very least express a bottle feed.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that there is really very, very little evidence for that, it's a very, very prevalent myth. Hence the sleep scapegoat, because breastfeeding just continually gets the blame, or responsive parenting in general gets the blame for a little one not sleeping the way a book sleeps. And it's because of a fundamental lack of understanding about the way that babies behave, essentially.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically.
Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. And if we think about us as health professionals or working within this field, most of us have not been given any sleep advice or sleep yes. training. I mean, maybe as a child health nurse or health visitor, depending on where you are in the world, that's a component to look at sleep and talk about that with new mums and parents. But as a pediatric nurse, as midwives who potentially are looking after women up until 6 weeks postpartum, and often sleep issues start coming up in the first few days in terms of, you know, awake more at night. And then in the first kind of 3 to 4 weeks, often feels like that's the time when, okay, I'm getting this breastfeeding stuff down packed, but hey, this baby's not sleeping how I want it to or how I have been told it should. And the questions of when should this baby be sleeping through the night is coming up.
Yes.
We're not giving that information out for yeah. health professionals to aid.
That's it's a big problem, because what happens is health professionals aren't trained in how to support sleep or how to understand sleep. There are some sort of additional providers that will train professionals in sleep, but it's not a statutory part of any health professional training. So I'm a health visitor by background, and I was only taught about sleep in a quite experiential way. It was something that I picked up from the people around me, from my mentors and from, you know, other health visitors. And we know from multiple research studies, mostly in breastfeeding, actually, that when people are not given training, they tend to default to personal experience and anecdata, which isn't great. Yeah. And so you get a lot of either patchy or just zero information or bad information. And so enter the sleep professionals, the sleep consultants, coaches, trainers, all of those people. And it's a completely unregulated industry. So they are completely at liberty to do and say whatever they want. And they can set themselves up as a sleep professional with no training in theory, because it's an unregulated industry. And that's when we start getting another layer of problems, which is the pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. So this is when we get things like just bad information. Your baby needs to be getting this many naps on these wake windows. If they're not getting naps of this length, it's not restorative. If they're not asleep by 7, they're missing out on deep sleep. And all of this stuff is not true. There is no scientific or biological basis to any of it. But it kind of sounds kind of half intelligent when people use the right buzzwords. So people throw in words like melatonin and non-REM sleep and, you know, restorative sleep. And all of a sudden it sounds quite clever. And people buy it because it sells a promise. It sells a dream. If you follow these wake windows, your baby will be content and settled and they'll be sleeping through the night. If you follow this downloadable, all will be well and sleep will return to your household. And they also sell through scaremongering. So, lots of parents are worried that if their baby is not sleeping like this or that, that something's going to happen to them, that they won't yeah. develop properly, that they're missing out on brain development. They're not going to grow. They're not going to thrive. They're not going to meet milestones. They're going to be cognitively impaired. And it just gets very, very murky. And so I wade around in these grey, murky waters trying to correct some of this misinformation. But you're right, it would really help if professionals had a robust, embedded program of learning what normal infant sleep looks like, but not just leaving it there, but also using knowledge of sleep biology to actually provide parents with some tips that have half a chance of optimizing sleep, rather than just saying that's normal, this too shall pass.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And it's really hard for people like us who witness that and see it as well, and have to bring that into our work and navigate around what's so kind of embedded. And you're right, those clever buzzwords really put that fear mongering in. And it's, yeah. Yes, thank you for bringing that up. I wanted to also ask, because you describe yourself, and I love this, as a fierce, gentle parenting advocate. And also you talked about the biological normality of sleep as well. And I just wondered if you could, we've talked about what's going on out there that's not so great, and how what you're describing is how that's different, and any.
Yeah. It's a slightly oxymoronic description of someone, isn't it? To be fiercely gentle.
I love it.
I'm fiercely protective,
yeah,
of biological normality, which usually requires responsiveness and gentleness. And it makes me angry when people peddle myths that compromise that. So that's why I'm fierce about it. But in terms of what I do that's different in it, and looking at those biological norms, one of the things that I probably bring up every single day, no, I'm going to cheat. There's two things that I say probably every day. One is I look at the average amount of sleep that is reported in very, very large scale population level data. And that's not based on my experience. It's not based on a cohort of a couple of hundred. These are huge population level studies that look at the range of total sleep that little ones at different ages achieve in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And when you really look at those total amounts of sleep, there are a few things you notice. One is that babies are almost certainly not sleep deprived in the main, which is one of the big fear mongering messages out there. If your baby's not getting this much sleep, they're not going to develop because they're going to be sleep deprived. The second thing is that there are outliers. So this is the same for any normal distribution of any characteristic, whether it's shoe size or IQ or body mass index or whatever it is. There are people who are going to be at the outliers of that normal distribution curve. So there are always going to be children who have what I call low sleep needs, and there are always going to be children who have high sleep needs. But a lot of the books and charts assume that a child has high sleep needs. And so if you take, for example, most children between approximately 6 to 8 months and about 2 years, they need 11 to 14 hours of total sleep in 24 hours. That's far less than many of the books would claim. So most books would say that children need 12 hours sleep overnight, plus a 2 hour lunchtime nap and a couple of shorter naps, which would put them beyond the upper range of that mean sleep range, which means that already most parents panic that their baby's not getting enough sleep. But coming back to looking at what those biological norms are means that perhaps we might make different decisions. Perhaps we might choose a later bedtime because that's more biologically normal.
Yes.
Perhaps we might not try and coax them into another sleep cycle for their nap, because actually there's only so much sleep they can get in 24 hours. And if they're getting 3 or 4 hours of daytime sleep, well, that you might pay for that overnight, right?
Yeah.
It's just plain logic. The other thing you notice about those biological norms is there's very, very little data about naps. People will try and tell you that they should be napping according to certain patterns or rhythms, but there's actually no evidence for any of it. So honestly, working out what works for an individual child is always going to be the thing to do. And that relates to the second thing that I say, probably on the daily, which is that sleep occurs in the parasympathetic state, the rest and digest state. It does not occur in the stress state. So to the masses, I say you can't sleep with your foot on the gas pedal. And what I mean is that if little ones are wound up in a funk, their nappies on too tight, they're hungry, they're bored, they're overstimulated, they're understimulated, they're picking up on a stressful, chaotic environment. If there's anything rattling them, they're not going to go to sleep. Yeah. So that's
just
why
like
one
us.
Of the most... Exactly. Like if you have a fight with a partner, mm-hmm. you try going to sleep on that.
Oh, it's not happening. Happen. I'm not one of those people who can roll over and go, we'll talk about it in the morning.
Nor me. I'm like, we're going to finish this.
Yeah,
we're going
so
to
I can
fight
sleep.
To the end.
Even if it's 4 hours.
Yes. I'm exactly the same.
Yeah.
I can't sleep with my foot on the gas pedal.
No.
Ain't happening. Babies aren't really that different from us. No. If they're bummed out by something, they're not going to go to sleep. Sure. And this is really tricky because kind of what I'm saying sometimes is if a parent is stressed out, babies are really perceptible. Mm. They can understand that there's something not quite right. So, mum's a bit stressed. I think I better not, wind down. I think I better just keep my guard up right now. I can't stand down because mum's upset by something, so I might need to react at any given moment. And that's not to make anyone feel bad. That's not to suggest that your baby's not going to sleep because you're stressed out, it's all your fault. I try and flip that around and say, well, I'm not surprised you're stressed, because actually having a baby is really hard work. Yeah. And parenting is kind of, there are some low points, let's face it. And it's really hard when you're tired, right? It's really hard when, like, I know your baby's tired and they probably need to nap, and that's really annoying and frustrating. And of course, that's stressing you out. And that's before we get to other stuff in your life. So relationship strains, work pressures, financial, stuff going on, and just all sorts of stuff in our lives that we bring to parenting. So it's no wonder you are dysregulated and stressed. However, if we can just find a way to help you park it just for 5 minutes and get you calmer, then the great news is that little ones are also really perceptive when we're calm. And so our calm can become contagious. And because babies sleep better when their foot is off the gas pedal, if we can calm them down, then as long as they are actually tired, they'll go to sleep. It's quite simple sometimes when you look at the biology of it, it's simple. Of course, it isn't simple because life is complicated and people are complicated, but actually the theory behind it is pretty straightforward.
I love that. I love that so much. And I'm really glad that you brought that up. I'm going to, because you've talked about when they're calm and getting them to that point, I'm going to touch on something that was released last week, the middle of September is when we're recording. So this came out in the Guardian newspaper, and you probably heard a lot about it. And it was reporting on research from Current Biology, that's the paper. And the researchers from Japan had recommended that parents pick up their crying baby, walk around with them for 5 minutes without any abrupt stops or sudden changes in direction, and then sit down and hold them for 5 to 8 minutes before lying them back down again. And I am sure that you have been discussing this or had DMs about this since it's been released, because it's of interest, and sleep is of great interest to probably every single person who's had a baby or has one currently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot that we can learn from other cultures. A lot of the research that exists in the sleep world is very white-centric. There is a lot of kind of weird centric, so, Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic kind of society driven research. So, for example, a lot of the sleep training literature is written in Australia, actually. Very, very homogenous populations, mostly white folks, higher socioeconomic status, higher educational attainment, all of that stuff. So it's not very generalizable to the people of the global majority, for a start. And personally, I'm really pleased to see a study coming out of Japan. There was another one a few months ago that came out of China, and it was looking at bed sharing. And I am genuinely really pleased to see these studies beginning to come out looking at other cultural approaches to sleep. And I think a lot of people slid into my DMs last week about this paper. Some yeah. people were saying, well, you know, duh, of course babies stop crying when you pick them up. I mean, shocker. And there is that angle to it. Other people were saying, why are they being so prescriptive about, you know, how long you should be holding them or pacing the room? And I think we have to kind of look at it at face value to some extent and realize that it was a study done looking at alternative ways to support parents who have crying babies.
Yeah.
And they were looking at approaches from, you know, other parts of the world where picking children up is more common, carrying children and keeping them close is more common, bed sharing is more common. And one of the things we can take from it is that, yes, of course, you know, on a very simple level, when you pick little ones up, of course they cry less. When you put them down straight away and they're wide awake, that's really not how babies are designed to fall asleep. Feeding induces a really amazing chemical cocktail of lots of different hormones that actually induce sleep. So it never surprises me when parents can't do that drowsy but awake thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what this study was kind of challenging. It was challenging in a roundabout way, in a very researchy, nerdy way, that drowsy but awake is not really something that most babies find easy. And I suppose 5 to 8 minutes, well, that's approximately the length of stage one sleep and then stage two sleep. So it assumes that a child will be in a more relaxed stage of sleep and rest before you put them down. So they're much less likely to panic and flail around mm-hmm. and startle. And then you kind of need to start all that process again.
Oh, yeah.
Am I going to start recommending widely and in a blanket kind of way that, you know, the best way to support babies to go to sleep is to walk them for 5 minutes and then sit down for 5 minutes? Probably not, because I am not a big fan of being prescriptive to anybody. I'm yeah. a big fan of acknowledging that different cultures do things in lots of different and sometimes brilliant ways.
Yeah.
And we can learn from that. And we need to be respectful of the way people manage sleep in other cultures. And that's a good thing. But we also need to just listen to babies. And I think it's brilliant that there is a study out there that demonstrates the efficacy of being more responsive. There are beginning to be more studies that are coming out that are looking at a more responsive approach. There was another one recently called the Play to Sleep study. And that was looking at, it was actually a randomized controlled trial, which is, you don't see that many randomized controlled trials with sleep because yeah. it's very difficult to randomize an intervention because everybody knows what intervention they're getting. But this was a randomized controlled trial. And the intervention was that a child health nurse, both sets of families, both in both groups, were instructed to just play with their little one for a set amount of time. So that was controlled between the two groups. But then the intervention was that one group of families had some feedback about how they were playing and how to observe their infant's cues and how to recognize their infant telling them, I've had enough, I want some more, I want to do something different, I need a change of position or a change of activity. And they were basically given one session of feedback.
Wow.
And that group of families actually reported fewer sleep problems. So the only difference was they had some feedback on play. It was nothing to do with sleep at all.
doing with observing their communication, which
just
is
about
often what we're not taught or taught as healthcare professionals to
Absolutely.
Teach parents and moms
Absolutely.
Or yeah. teaching moms. I or was a certified infant massage instructor, and that was the main thing. So whenever anyone said to me, oh yeah, I'm doing baby massage, I would always say it's more about actually picking up on cues and communication,
yes.
particularly with my midwife and lactation background. It really broadened my ability to show mums and parents how to go, this might be happening now. This could be a sign of that they're overstimulated. This is possibly a sign they're not enjoying that, or maybe change the movement or slow down, or this is a sign they're getting tired. And, you know, within those classes that I was then running, it was so many other things that come from it, not just that kind of nurturing touch bonding, but really that nurturing of connection and being able to read your baby. It's like learning, and I always say breastfeeding and being with a baby is like learning another language, and I'm trying to do that myself at the moment, and it is really hard. So
yes.
why would it not be really hard with a newborn? And you know, then you've got it down pat, and they're 4 months and things change, and then they're 6 months and then they go to school, and it continues. It's a continual
yes.
learning. But having that reassurance, I'm not surprised by those outcomes.
Yeah.
It's
no,
fabulous.
Nor am I.
And
nor
yet
am
it's
I.
Such an easy intervention. Why are we now not seeing that blow up in the newspapers? And we're teaching that globally or nationally as a, you know, part of neonatal nursing, child health or health visiting and pediatric nursing.
Yes. I mean, there are programs. I'm Braselton trained, and you know, lots of people are NIDCAP trained in the NICU. Lots
yep.
of people have done programs like, you know, Look at Me, I'm Talking to You, and Watch, Wait and Wonder, and that there are lots and lots of different programs, but they're not embedded within core training. Absolutely.
You have to have an interest and then go and pay for it.
Yeah, yeah. But, so, I mean, I guess I don't know if I've answered your question about the Japanese study, but I suppose the bottom line is I'm pleased to see it. It was a pilot study. It was a very small group
yeah.
of parents, as was the play to sleep study, for that matter. Mm-hmm. That was a small randomized control trial as well. And, you know, we don't know what the right dose, so to speak, would be. You know,
yeah.
would two doses of that feedback would that be even better? Would it be twice as good, or would it, you know, we've got no idea. We don't know how that would fly. But I think, you know, what a lot of these studies are telling us is when we wait for babies to be ready, when we invest in understanding them better, both of those studies would suggest that actually sleep outcomes improve, parents are less stressed. When parents are less stressed and they feel more equipped and empowered, and they have a higher degree of self-efficacy, we know that improves their relationship. We know it improves their understanding of their child, which optimizes bonding and attachment. And all of that stuff indirectly improves sleep, because you can't sleep with your foot on the gas pedal. I get very boring about saying that, but it's true.
Very true. I'm going to ask you after that, which possibly is a silly question, but I just want to make it clear. Is there then any need for us to be starting particular practices or routines at certain ages, like feed, play, sleep, or starting the, like a certain bedtime at 6 weeks or 4 weeks? Or if you miss starting this at 6 weeks, then you're never going to get your baby into this routine. And even though this is kind of a message that is given across as quite gentle, completely opposite from the kind of extreme of controlled crying, like leaving the baby, letting them cry, shut the door and don't you cry, new mum, because clearly that's not what you're going to do. Is there anything that we can be starting early, or is it this approach which you've been talking about?
So I think first of all we have to separate the difference between a schedule and a routine. And having a routine just means you do the same things in the same order. There's nothing wrong with ever doing the same things in the same order, as long as people have got a very clear understanding that we're not talking about a fixed time on that. So, for example, there's no harm in when you feel like your baby is tired, going into, you know, a familiar place and singing the same little song and, you know, maybe reading them the same little book and then saying goodnight to the teddies in the same order. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with having, you know, a bath and then a massage and then putting on pajamas and reading a book and snuggling down and having a feed and putting them to bed. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. They're all nurturing, responsive behaviors. What becomes non-responsive is when we're trying to kind of squeeze babies into a fixed schedule and we're saying, right, it's 6 o'clock, we're going to start the bedtime routine, and not being willing to be flexible and realize that actually this baby is not showing signs of tiredness right now. That's important, because what I often see is if people start a bedtime routine too early before the circadian drive for sleep has kicked in, what we get is a really alert child.
Yeah.
And then the parent interprets that as the baby is fighting sleep and, you know, refusing to go to bed, and it gets labeled as a sort of bedtime battle.
Yeah.
And actually it isn't. It's just you're trying to put a child to bed who's not tired. You try going to sleep, you know, assuming you're not chronically sleep deprived, you try putting yourself to bed at, I don't know, 8 o'clock one night, assuming you're not a really early bird. I'm a night owl, so I'm not normally asleep much before midnight. If I tried to go to bed at 10, guaranteed I'll lie there for 2 hours being frustrated.
I was going to say the frustration kicks in then, doesn't it?
Yeah. But because we don't have a verbal child, what we end up getting is a frustrated little one who has only got one tool, and that's probably either to cry or to start wriggling and squirming around and try the best they can to make life interesting for themselves, because it's really boring being put to bed when you're not tired, right?
Absolutely.
So we end up getting this frustration from parents and, you know, a sense that they're getting it all wrong. Their baby is some kind of deviant, or, you know, that why is it not working? We're following the book, but the baby's not doing what the book says they should be doing. And now they're going to be sleep deprived and they're going to start Googling over tiredness and all sorts of stuff's going to start happening, and people panic. And then, you know, the solution to all of that is actually learning how to read infant cues. So the one thing I think people could do from early on, which was one of the many questions I think you asked.
I was trying to pull out a lot of things. Thank you.
You were.
You're doing brilliantly.
Great. I loved it. I speak fluent, knackered, so it's fine. I can interpret most of those sort of questions. So the other thing that I think we should be talking to parents about is infant cues. And I really like Leah Kuiper's work. Leah Kuiper's is a pediatric occupational therapist, and she basically took people like Stephen Porges and Brazelton's work around the states of regulation, and she kind of simplified it. So rather than talking about, you know, the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system and, you know, hypofreeze and hyperfreeze and all these really nerdy scientific terms, she talks about four zones, the four zones of regulation. She talks about the blue zone, which is obviously the parasympathetic state. This is where little ones are sleepy, they're relaxed, they are ready to fall asleep. Then we have the green zone. The green zone is a baby who is just entering the sympathetic state. So they're alert, but they're organized. Their movements are organized. They are they're content. They're ready to learn. They're ready to play. They're ready to communicate. That's still not a baby who's going to go to sleep anytime soon. So it's really important to recognize when you've got a baby in the green zone, because a baby in the green zone isn't going to go to sleep. Then we've got the yellow zone. The yellow zone is when little ones start to get a little bit dysregulated. We might see some slightly disorganized movements, or they're whinging or fussing or, you know, avoiding eye contact, and they're beginning to get upset by something. And again, that's when that gas pedal is beginning to get pressed down a little bit more. And at that point, they might also be tired, but you can't be, you can't go to sleep if you're stressed. So even if you've got a little one who is tired and rattled, we need to deal with the rattled part first before they're going to go to sleep. So the yellow zone is so important to observe and watch for, because if we can get them back to green or blue, then we're going to be more likely to help facilitate sleep. And then we've got, finally, we've got the red zone. The red zone is meltdown. We all know what red looks like. We've got a crying baby who's not happy. You know, they're not able to recruit any strategies to calm themselves down at that point. They've lost it. So these four zones, I wish every parent knew about the four zones of regulation, because it, once you've explained them once, and it hasn't taken me that long to explain that really, I think if every parent knew how to look at their baby and watch, because those transitions between yellow and green or green to blue can actually be quite, they can fluctuate a little bit. So you can see a baby who's green on their playmat and then they go yellow, and you can tell they're yellow because they're going and they're starting to fuss and flap around and they're not happy. And then you give them a new toy and they go back to green. Or you move them from their back onto their tummy and they go back to green. Or conversely, they go to yellow and you think, oh, that didn't work. Let's move you back. Whoops. Nice try, but that didn't go down well. But just watching and observing the blue, green, yellow and red, I think would transform a lot of the way that we look at little ones and how we decide whether they're ready for sleep or actually whether they just want to hang out. Don't put a green baby to bed. They're not going to go to bed. They want to play with you. Simple, huh? She says. I know it's not that simple. I know that, you know.
No, but you've just described that. That's what this big, long, convoluted question was trying to go. I just want to pull out. I want to pull that out. And that.
Something useful.
Oh, my God. This is so useful. People hearing this, there'll be most. I would imagine most people will be hearing this for the first time. And it is so, and that's the first time I've heard about those zones, I have to say. I've not heard about them in colours before. And I love that. That works really good.
Oh, thank you, Leah. It's not me. So
if, no, again, I will link just, to so the author.
It's definitely Leah Kuipers. I'll send you the link. She definitely needs the credit for that. But it's just brilliant. And she obviously probably wasn't thinking about sleep per se. She's an occupational therapist. So, you know, this is something that I first learned about in a neurodiverse context, and helping to support children who are neurodiverse, who are beginning to get dysregulated and looking at things like their sensory needs. But so many of these tools we can borrow and we can adapt and we can apply to other settings and situations, because they're so practical and useful. And regulation is regulation, and we're all, you know, we all kind of sidle between green and yellow, you know. And actually, I challenge everybody to think about times as an adult that they feel like, oh, I'm green right now. I'm feeling, you know, calm and quiet and relaxed, but also alert. This is green versus, actually, I'm feeling kind of yellow. I think I need a snack. That's usually what I need. I need a snack.
Or angry. Or becoming hangry.
Just hangry. Or I need to go outside. My dog is yellow. She's beginning, you can't see, but she's beginning to paw and pester me. She's definitely yellow. She probably needs a wee, right? So, you know, we all have these kind of needs that affect our ability to self-regulate. And then, of course, we have to remember that little ones have very, very few strategies that they can recruit to be able to self-regulate. So, yeah, that's bad news, isn't it? Because they require our co-regulation to be able to get us from yellow to green. Uh-huh. And that's why babies are hard work, because they can't just go from yellow to blue without any parental intervention. Yeah. 99 times out of 100. There are some babies who have more abilities to self-regulate, which is something they're born with. But most babies need parental support to do that. frankly, most children do. I mean, I've got a teenager who quite often needs some help to get from yellow to green or yellow to blue. Can't remember. Yesterday's meltdown was about when the design project is due in. So that was a yellow moment in our house. Could have gone red. Could have, you know, if we hadn't nipped that nonsense in the bud, that could have easily gone red quite quickly.
But you were able to identify we're in yellow.
We're
what yellow. Strategies, Jeepers, what strategies can I pull in to manage this one? That's the thing. The next learning phase, when I'm not even going into teenagers, that's a different podcast. Wow. I'm not involved
that's
with that
another
one.
Podcast.
So I suppose I want to bring us to a close so we can let that puppy of yours go out and have a wee. And I've got to think of the animals. I'd like to do a podcast on animals. and also let us go and drink warm tea and cough and
sores, you know,
snort everywhere. Yeah, stress. Yeah. So Lindsay, do you think control crying is dying out? Are we going to see the end of this kind of teaching practice?
It's a tricky one because I feel like I look at these enormous pages with, you know, a million followers, and they're not doing anything new. They're doing usually non-responsive sleep training. That's what they're promoting. And the trouble is that it has the appearance of working for a lot of people. And I think for that reason, it probably is going to carry on.
Mm.
And people often ask me, you know, does it work? And is it definitely harmful? And I talk about kind of three responses to non-responsive sleep training that I've seen. I don't promote it. I've never used it in my practice. I don't recommend it. But I acknowledge the three types of response that I see. One is the rapid responder. So some children do seem to get kind of, in inverted commas, the message about sleep training quite quickly. So these are the little ones who, you know, they might cry for 20 minutes. They don't cry for very long. And it's 2 days, you know, 2-3 days of 20 minutes here and there crying. And I call those the rapid responders. And I do think they're out there. And the trouble is the people who shout the loudest about the positives of sleep training are often the rapid responder parents.
Yes.
Because they are speaking from their experience, which was, it wasn't great. You know, crikey, I didn't like it that much. It's not nice to listen to your baby crying, but it really wasn't that bad. Like, you
and
know.
It's worked.
And it's worked.
Yeah, worked.
And, you know, when people say, do you think that's harmful? Do you think that's messed up attachment? You know, I think we have to be pragmatic here and say, well, in with the rapid responders, do I really think in the context of an otherwise responsive, loving relationship, do I think that's likely to undo months and months of hard work? No. I mean, babies are more resilient than that.
Yeah.
You know, the human race is quite robust. We can cope with periods of stress like that, provided there isn't something else major in our life that is causing us to be vulnerable in another way. However, I also see another response, which is the slow responders. And the slow responders, they are the ones that, you know, they might cry longer and louder. So they might cry for, you know, an hour or a couple of hours or 2 or 3 hours. And the crying on and off might go on for more like 1 to 2 weeks. And do I think those babies are having a harder time? Absolutely. Why is that? Well, it might be to do with their temperament, it might be to do with, you know, internal vulnerabilities. It might be to do with their character. It might be to do with a more difficult home environment. Who knows what it is, but they're definitely having a harder time. And then I also see and hear about the non-responders. And these are the ones I worry about. The non-responders, those parents are consistent and persistent. And yet those babies carry on crying. They cry and cry. They cry long and loud. And, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks down the line, it's still not really working. Am I more concerned about the stress levels and the attachment for those babies? Yes. Do I think they're definitely being harmed? I can't prove that. At the moment, there is no conclusive, there's no conclusive proof of harm, but there's also not really any proof of safety of sleep training. But I think while we have the rapid responders and while we have people talking about that as the typical response, even though that might not represent reality, because the truth is the sleep training studies are probably not recruiting people who know their little ones, probably a non-responder to start with. Yeah. I suspect that the people who end up in these studies know that actually their little one is probably going to cope with this pretty well. Your parents have a pretty good idea about the character of their child. And I genuinely think that when we look at those studies that say, oh, there's no harm in sleep training, I just don't think it's a representative sample of the population and all of the different sensitivities and characters and temperaments of little ones that we see in the population. So your question was, do I think it's dying out? No, but I do also think that the responsive sleep message is getting louder. And I think in the same way that we sometimes see kind of fierce debate between breastfeeding and formula feeding, I think whenever we get one kind of minority voice getting louder, we're going to see more and more arguments about this erupting. So we're going to see more and more arguments about responsive sleep versus non-responsive sleep. The sleep training argument is going to get louder, but so too is the responsive sleep argument. Yeah. So I don't think we've seen the last of it, but it's probably not going to stop me shouting about responsive sleep. So yeah, if you're pro non-responsive sleep, sorry about that. You're probably going to put up with me shouting.
You shout away, Lindsay. You have just, I think, answered all the questions I wanted you to answer and more, and just brought so much to the table. You have a fantastic course online called Holistic Sleep Coaching. Would you tell us a little bit about that and who it's aimed at?
Sure. So it started because of what we started this podcast talking about, which is that there is no training for the people who are likely to be most influential in supporting families with their little one's sleep, which is, you know, the health professionals out there, the lactation advocates. And so I realized that although it's a non-regulated industry, we had to have a program that was evidence-based and robust and culturally aware and inclusive, and a program that actually talks about realistic expectations and biological norms for sleep, but at the same time provides some genuinely useful practical strategies to support parents who are really struggling. So that's how the Holistic Sleep Coaching Program was born. We attract health visitors, midwives, doulas, baby massage instructors, sling consultants, health professionals of all kinds, lactation advocates of all different types as well, and also people who have been transformed forever by becoming a parent and deciding, actually, I didn't realize that this was such a meaningful time, and I want to be able to support families who are making this transition into parenthood. And my goodness, sleep was the thing that nearly derailed my mental health completely, and I want to support other families. So yeah, so we've been doing that now for, goodness, 5 years, and I'm really proud of the graduates that we've trained, because they are I genuinely think they are helping to change the narrative about sleep, about the way that people sleep. And also they're helping to shift away from that dichotomous wait it out versus cry it out narrative, which isn't very helpful. Parents now know that there is another way. It's not necessarily easy. You can't necessarily follow a quick downloadable plan, but there is another way. You don't have to suffer in silence.
That's marvelous. Lindsay, tell us where people can find you before I let you go and take that beautiful doggy of yours out for a wee wee.
She's not very subtle, is she? So you can find me in all over the place. So I'm easy to find on socials. I'm Lindsay _Hookway. Just make sure you spell the Lindsay part right. My parents gave me a name no one can spell. So, thanks for that, Mum and Dad.
We will have all your links in our show notes. So don't worry, people. You can just click on them.
Just click on the link. There we go. You can't go wrong with that. So find me on socials. I'm pretty friendly. And I do a free Q&A every week as well. So that's where a lot of folks come and gather and glean tips every Wednesday. And you can also come and find me on my websites, which I'm sure you'll put links to as well.
I most definitely will, because there are several.
There are a few, yeah.
There are a few.
Fingers in lots of pies.
You have got fingers in lots of pies. You've done some other and are doing some other incredible projects as well. I will definitely link to those. It has been an absolute joy to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so grateful. It's just been brilliant.
Stirring us up in your little melting pot.
In a little bubbling pot.
A little bubbling pot with a little cocker spaniel putting her two pennyworth in right now.
She's rather beautiful, folks. One day we will get round to recording these podcasts, but for now you've just got to imagine it. So I'm going to say thank you very much.
And thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. So get on the socials, start sharing, and pop on over and leave us a review and a comment on your podcast host. Because you know what I'm going to say? And I say it every time. It's what gets more people listening. And more people listening means more positive change. And that's what we all want, ain't it? If you would like to support the show further with a donation to help us keep this show on the road, then head to the links at the bottom of the show notes or in my bio at The Midwife's Cauldron. From as little as $2, you can make a massive difference to keeping content like this coming at ya. And whilst you're there, pop on over to my website and sign up for all my new stuff coming soon. And go on, say hello to Rachel too. She's way ahead of me with 2 courses, books. But just you wait. 2023, it's going to be a jam-packed year full of content for yous. From me as well. So all I've got to say now is, see you next time. Oh yeah, and here's the bloopers.
She's so funny. She knows when I'm wrapping up. She's always a twat like this though.
Probably she's a cocker spaniel. She got a mix in her.
She's a cockapoo, but she's mostly cock and very little poo, really.
I think that's the best combination.
All cock and no poo.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch.
Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.